information, thus exposing each and confirming the exposure. But why? To whom? We know what and who he is now, but he relays nothing to Washington. He refuses to surface. To suggest an answer, said the beggar, I would have to go back many years. But it's possible he wants no interference from his superiors. American intelligence has its share of vacillating autocrats, rarely communicating fully with each other. In the days of the Cold War, money was made selling information 3 and 4 times over to the same stations. Perhaps Kane waits until he thinks there is only one course of action to be taken, no differing strategies to be argued by those above. Age hasn't dulled your sense of maneuver, old friend. It's why I called upon you. Or perhaps, continued the beggar, he really has turned. It's happened. I don't think so, but it doesn't matter. Washington thinks he has. The monk is dead. They're all dead at Treadstone. Kane is established as the killer. The monk, said the beggar. A name from the past. He was active in Berlin, in Vienna. We knew him well, healthier for it from a distance. There's your answer, Carlos. It was always the monk's style to reduce the numbers to as few as possible. He operated on the theory that his circles were infiltrated, compromised. He must have ordered Kane to report only to him. It would explain Washington's confusion, the months of silence. Would it explain ours? For months there was no word, no activity. A score of possibilities. Illness, exhaustion, brought back for new training. Even to spread confusion to the enemy. The monk had a cathedral full of tricks. Yet before he died, he said to an associate that he did not know what had happened, that he wasn't even certain the man was Kane. Who was the associate? A man named Gillette. He was our man, but Abbott couldn't have known it. Another possible explanation. The monk had an instinct about such men. It was said in Vienna that David Abbott would distrust Christ on the mountain and look for a bakery. It's possible. Your words are comforting. You look for things others do not look for. I've had far more experience. I was once a man of stature. Unfortunately, I pissed away the money. You still do. A profligate. What can I tell you? Obviously, something else. You are perceptive, Carlos. We should have known each other in the old days. Now you're presumptuous. Always. You know that I know you can swat my life away at any moment you choose, so I must be of value. And not merely with words that come from experience. What have you got to tell me? This may not be of great value, but it is something. I put on respectable clothes and spent the day at the Auberge du Coin. There was a man, an obese man, questioned and dismissed by the Sûreté, whose eyes were too unsteady, and he perspired too much. I had a chat with him, showing him an official NATO identification I had made in the early '50s. It seems he negotiated the rental of an automobile at 3 o'clock yesterday morning to a blonde man in the company of a woman. The description fits the photograph from Argenteuil. A rental? Supposedly. The car was to be returned within a day or so by the woman. It will never happen. Of course not. But it raises a question, doesn't it? Why would Kane go to the trouble of obtaining an automobile in such a fashion? to get as far away as possible, as rapidly as possible. In which case, the information has no value, said the beggar. But then there are so many ways to travel faster, less conspicuously. And Bourne could hardly trust an avaricious night clerk. He might easily look for a reward from the Sûreté, or anyone else. What's your point? I suggest that Bourne could have obtained that car for the sole purpose of following someone here in Paris. No loitering in public where he might be spotted, no rented cars that could be traced, no frantic searches for elusive taxis. Instead, a simple exchange of license plates and a nondescript black Renault in the crowded streets. Where would one begin to look? The silhouette turned. The Lavier woman, said the assassin softly, and everyone else he suspects at Les Classiques. It's the only place he has to start. They'll be watched, and within days, hours perhaps, a nondescript black Renault will be seen and he'll be found. Do you have a full description of the car? Down to 3 dents in the left rear fender. Good. Spread the word to the old men. Comb the streets, the garages, the parking lots. The one who finds it will never have to look for work again. Speaking of such matters, an envelope was slipped between the taut edge of the curtain and the blue felt of the frame. If your theory proves right, consider this a token. I am right, Carlos. Why are you so convinced? Because Cain does what you would do, what I would have done, in the old days. He must be respected. He must be killed, said the assassin. There's symmetry in the timing. In a few days it will be the 25th of March. On March 25th, 1968, Jason Bourne was executed in the jungles of Tam Quan. Now, years later, nearly to the day, another Jason Bourne is hunted, the Americans as anxious as we are to see him killed. I wonder which of us will pull the trigger this time. Does it matter? I want him, whispered the silhouette. He was never real. And that's his crime against me. Tell the old men that if any find him, get word to Parmenceau, but do nothing. Keep him in sight, but do nothing. I want him alive on the 25th of March. On March 25th, I'll execute him myself and deliver his body to the Americans. The word will go out immediately. Angelus Domini, child of God. Angelus Domini, said the beggar. Chapter 26. The old soldier walked in silence beside the younger man down the moonlit path in the Bois de Boulogne. Neither spoke, for too much had already been said, admitted, challenged, denied, and reaffirmed. Villiers had to reflect and analyze, to accept or violently reject what he had heard. His life would be far more bearable if he could strike back in anger, attack the lie, and find his sanity again. But he could not do that with impunity. He was a soldier, and to turn away was not in him. There was too much truth in the younger man. It was in his eyes, in his voice, in his every gesture that asked for understanding. The man without a name was not lying. The ultimate treason was in Villiers' house. It explained so many things he had not dared to question before. An old man wanted to weep. For the man without a memory, there was little to change or invent. The chameleon was not called upon. His story was convincing because the most vital part was based in the truth. He had to find Carlos, learn what the assassin knew. There would be no life for him if he failed. Beyond this, he would say nothing. There was no mention of Marie Saint-Jacques, or the Ile de Port Noir, or a message being sent by person or persons unknown, or a walking hollow shell that might or might not be someone he was or was not, who could not even be sure that the fragments of memories he possessed were really his own. None of this was spoken of. Instead, he recounted everything he knew about the assassin called Carlos. That knowledge was so vast that during the telling, Villiers stared at him in astonishment, recognizing information he knew to be highly classified, shocked at new and startling data that was in concert with a dozen existing theories, but to his ears never before put forth with such clarity. Because of his son, the general had been given access to his country's most secret files on Carlos, and nothing in those records matched the younger man's array of facts. "This woman you spoke with in Argentry, the one who calls my house, who admitted being a courier to you." "Her name is Lavier," Bourne interrupted. The general paused.
"Thank you. She saw through you. She had your photograph taken."
"Yes."
"They had no photograph before."
"No."
"So as you hunt Carlos, he in turn hunts you. But you have no photograph. You only know two couriers, one of which was at my house."
"Yes."
"Speaking with my wife."
"Yes." The old man turned away. The period of silence had begun. They came to the end of the path, where there was a miniature lake. It was bordered with white gravel, benches spaced every 10 to 15 feet, circling the water like a guard of honor surrounding a grave of black marble. They walked to the second bench. Villiers broke his silence.
"I should like to sit down," he said.
"With age there comes a paucity of stamina. It often embarrasses me."
"It shouldn't," said Bourne, sitting down beside him.
"It shouldn't," agreed the general, "but it does."
He paused for a moment, adding quietly,
"Frequently, in the company of my wife."
"That's not necessary," said Jason.
"You mistake me."
The old man turned to the younger.
"I'm not referring to the bed. There are simply times when I find it necessary to curtail activities. Leave a dinner party early. Absent myself on weekends to the Mediterranean, or decline a few days on the slopes in Gstaad."
"I'm not sure I understand."
"My wife and I are often apart. In many ways we live quite separate lives, taking pleasure, of course, in each other's pursuits."
"I still don't understand."
"Must I embarrass myself further?" said Villiers. "When an old man finds a stunning young woman anxious to share his life, certain things are understood, others not so readily. There is, of course, financial security, and in my case, a degree of public exposure. Creature comforts, entry into the great houses, easy friendship with the celebrated. It's all very understandable. In exchange for these things, one brings a beautiful companion into his home, shows her off among his peers. A form of continuing virility, as it were. But there are always doubts."
The old soldier stopped for several moments. What he had to say was not easy for him.
"Will she take a lover?"
he continued softly.
"Does she long for a younger, firmer body? One more in tune with her own. If she does, one can accept it. Even be relieved, I imagine, hoping to God she has the sense to be discreet. A cuckolded statesman loses his constituency faster than a sporadic drunk. It means he's fully lost his grip. There are other worries. Will she abuse his name? Publicly condemn an adversary whom one is trying to convince? These are the inclinations of the young. They are manageable, part of the risks in the exchange. But there is one underlying doubt that, if proved justified, cannot be tolerated.
and that is if she is part of a design. From the beginning.
You've felt it then? Asked Jason quietly.
Feelings are not reality, shot back the old soldier vehemently. They have no place in observing the field.
Then why are you telling me this? Villiers' head arched back, then fell forward, his eyes on the water.
There could be a simple explanation for what we both saw tonight. I pray there is, and I shall give her every opportunity to provide it.
The old man paused again.
But in my heart, I know there isn't. I knew it the moment you told me about Lake Lasix. I looked across the street, at the door of my house, and suddenly a number of things fell painfully into place. For the past 2 hours I have played the devil's advocate. There is no point in continuing. There was my son before there was this woman.
But you said you trusted her judgment, that she was a great help to you.
True. You see, I wanted to trust her, desperately wanted to trust her. The easiest thing in the world is to convince yourself that you're right. As one grows old, it is easier still.
What fell into place for you?
The very help she gave me, the very trust I placed in her.
Villiers turned and looked at Jason.
You have extraordinary knowledge about Carlos. I've studied those files as closely as any man alive, for I would give more than any man alive to see him caught and executed. I alone, the firing squad. And as swollen as they are, those files do not approach what you know. Yet your concentration is solely on his kills, his methods of assassination. You've overlooked the other side of Carlos. He not only sells his gun, he sells a country's secrets.
I know that, Bourne said.
It's not the side. For example, continued the general, as if he had not heard Jason, I have access to classified documents dealing with France's military and nuclear security. Perhaps 5 other men, all above suspicion, share that access. Yet with damning regularity we find that Moscow has learned this, Washington that, Peking something else.
You discussed those things with your wife? Asked Bourne, surprised.
Of course not. Whenever I bring such papers home, they are placed in a vault in my office. No one may enter that room except in my presence. There is only one other person who has a key. One other person who knows the whereabouts of the alarm switch. My wife.
I'd think that would be as dangerous as discussing the material. Both could be forced from her.
There was a reason. I'm at the age when the unexpected is a daily occurrence. I commend you to the obituary pages. If anything happened to me, she is instructed to telephone the conseiller militaire. Go down to my office, and stay by that vault until the security personnel arrive.
Couldn't she simply stay by the door?
Men of my years have been known to pass away at their desks.
Villiers closed his eyes.
All along it was she. The one house, the one place, no one believed possible.
Are you sure?
More than I dare admit to myself. She was the one who insisted on the marriage. I repeatedly brought up the disparity of our ages, but she would have none of it. It was the years together, she claimed, not those that separated our birth dates. She offered to sign an agreement renouncing any claims to the Villiers estate, and of course, I would have none of that, for it was proof of her commitment to me. The adage is quite right. The old fool is the complete fool. Yet there were always the doubts. They came with the trips, with the unexpected separations.
Unexpected?
She has many interests, forever demanding her attention. A Franco-Swiss museum in Grenoble, a fine arts gallery in Amsterdam, a monument of the resistance in Boulogne-sur-Mer, an idiotic oceanography conference in Marseille. We had a heated argument over that one. I needed her in Paris. There were diplomatic functions I had to attend and wanted her with me. She would not stay. It was as though she were being ordered to be here and there and somewhere else at a given moment. Grenoble, near the Swiss border, an hour from Zurich. Amsterdam, Boulogne-sur-Mer, on the Channel, an hour from London. Marseille? Carlos. When was the conference in Marseille? Asked Jason. Last August, I believe. 'Twas the latter part of the month. On August 26th, at 5 o'clock in the afternoon, Ambassador Howard Leland was assassinated on the Marseille waterfront. Yes, I know, said Villiers. You spoke of it before. I mourn the passing of the man, not his judgments. The old soldier stopped. He looked at Bourne. My God, he whispered. She had to be with him. Carlos summoned her and she came to him. She obeyed. I never went this far, said Jason. I swear to you I thought of her as a relay. A blind relay. I never went this far. Suddenly, from the old man's throat came a scream, deep and filled with agony and hatred. He brought his hands to his face, his head arched back once again in the moonlight, and he wept. Bourne did not move. There was nothing he could do. I'm sorry, he said. The general regained control. And so am I, he replied finally. I apologize. No need to. I think there is. We will discuss it no further. I shall do what has to be done. Which is? The soldier sat erect on the bench, his jaw firm. You can ask that? I have to ask it. Having done what she's done is no different from having killed the child of mine she did not bear. She pretended to hold his memory dear. Yet she was and is an accomplice to his murder. And all the while she committed a second treason against the nation I have served throughout my life. You're going to kill her? I'm going to kill her. She will tell me the truth, and she will die. She'll deny everything you say. I doubt it. That's crazy. Young man, I've spent over half a century trapping and fighting the enemies of France, even when they were Frenchmen. The truth will be heard. What do you think she's going to do? Sit there and listen to you and calmly agree that she's guilty? She'll do nothing calmly. But she'll agree. She'll proclaim it. Why would she? Because when I accuse her, she'll have the opportunity to kill me. When she makes the attempt, I will have my explanation, won't I? You'd take that risk. I must take it. Suppose she doesn't make the attempt, doesn't try to kill you. That would be another explanation, Villiers said. In that unlikely event, I should look to my flanks if I were you, monsieur. He shook his head. It will not happen. We both know it. I far more clearly than you. Listen to me, insisted Jason. You say there was your son first. Think of him. Go after the killer, not the accomplice. She's an enormous wound for you, but he's a greater wound. Get the man who killed your son. In the end, you'll get both. Don't confront her, not yet. Use what you know against Carlos. Hunt him with me. No one's ever been this close.
You ask more than I can give, said the old man.
Not if you think about your son. If you think of yourself, it is, but not if you think of the Rue de Bac.
You are excessively cruel, monsieur.
I'm right, and you know it.
A high cloud floated by in the night sky, briefly blocking the light of the moon. Darkness was complete. Jason shivered. The old soldier spoke, resignation in his voice.
"Yes, you are right," he said. "Excessively cruel and excessively right. It's the killer, not the whore, who must be stopped. How do we work together? Hunt together?"
Bourne closed his eyes briefly in relief. "Don't do anything. Carlos has to be looking for me all over Paris. I've killed his men, uncovered a drop, found a contact. I'm too close to him. Unless we're both mistaken, your telephone will get busier and busier. I'll make sure of it."
"How?"
"I'll intercept a half a dozen employees of Les Classiques. Several clerks, the Lavier woman, Bergeron maybe, and certainly the man at the switchboard. They'll talk. And so will I. That phone of yours will be busy as hell."
"But what of me? What do I do?"
"Stay home. Say you're not feeling well. And whenever that phone rings, stay near whoever else answers. Listen to the conversation. Try to pick up codes. Question the servants as to what was said to them. You could even listen in. If you hear something, fine, but you probably won't. Whoever's on the line will know you're there. Still, you'll frustrate the relay. And depending upon where your wife is, the whore is," broke in the old soldier. "In Carlos' hierarchy, we might even force him to come out."
"Again? How?"
"His lines of communication will be disrupted. The secure, unthinkable relay will be interfered with. He'll demand a meeting with your wife."
"He would hardly announce the whereabouts."
"He has to tell her." Bourne paused, another thought coming into focus. "If the disruption is severe enough, there'll be that one phone call, or that one person you don't know coming to the house, and shortly after, your wife will tell you she has to go somewhere. When it happens, insist she leave a number where she can be reached. Be firm about it. You're not trying to stop her from going, but you must be able to reach her. Tell her anything. Use the relationship she developed. Say it's a highly sensitive military matter you can't talk about until you get a clearance. Then you want to discuss it with her before you render a judgment. She might jump at it."
"What will it serve?"
"She'll be telling you where she is. Maybe where Carlos is. If not Carlos, certainly others closer to him. Then reach me. I'll give you a hotel and a room number. The name on the registry is meaningless. Don't bother about it."
"Why don't you give me your real name?"
"Because if you ever mentioned it, consciously or unconsciously, you'd be dead."
"I'm not senile."
"No, you're not. But you're a man who's been hurt very badly. As badly as a person can be hurt, I think. You may risk your life. I won't."
"You're a strange man, monsieur."
"Yes. If I'm not there when you call, a woman will answer. She'll know where I am. We'll set up timing for messages."
"A woman?"
The general drew back.
"You've said nothing about a woman, or anyone else."
"There is no one else. Without her, I wouldn't be alive. Carlos is hunting both of us. He's tried to kill both of us."
"Does she know about me?"
"Yes. She's the one who said it couldn't be true. That you couldn't be allied with Carlos. I thought you were."
"Perhaps I'll meet her."
"Not likely. Until Carlos is taken, if he can be taken, we can't be seen with you. Of all people, not you. Afterwards, if there is an afterwards, you may not want to be seen with us. With me. I'm being honest with you."
"I understand that, and I respect it.
In any event, thank this woman for me. Thank her for thinking I could be no part of Carlos." Bourne nodded. "Can you be sure your private line isn't tapped?"
"Absolutely. It is swept on a regular basis. All the telephones restricted by the conseiller are. Whenever you expect a call from me, answer the phone and clear your throat twice. I'll know it's you. If for any reason you can't talk, tell me to call your secretary in the morning. I'll call back in 10 minutes. What's the number? Villiers gave it to him. The hotel? Asked the general. The terrasse, Rue de Maistre, Montmartre, room 420. When will you begin? As soon as possible. Noon today. Be like a wolf pack, said the old soldier, leaning forward, a commander instructing his officer corps. Strike swiftly. Chapter 27.
She was so charming. I simply must do something for her, cried Marie in ebullient French into the telephone. Also for this sweet young man. He was of such help. I tell you, the dress was a success, fou. I'm so grateful.
From your descriptions, madame, replied the cultured male voice on the switchboard at Les Classiques, I'm sure you mean Jeanine and Claude.
Yes, of course. Jeanine and Claude, I remember now. I'll drop each a note with a token of my thanks. Would you by any chance know their last names?
I mean, it seems so crass to address envelopes simply to Jeanine and Claude. Rather like sending missives to servants, don't you think?
Could you ask Jacqueline?
It's not necessary, madame. I know them. And may I say that madame is as sensitive as she is generous. Jeanine d'Albert and Claude Auréal. Jeanine d'Albert and Claude Auréal, repeated Marie, looking at Jason.
Jeanine is married to that cute pianist, isn't she?
I don't believe Mademoiselle d'Albert is married to anyone.
Of course, I'm thinking of someone else.
If I may, madame, I didn't catch your name.
How silly of me.
Marie thrust the phone away and raised her voice.
Darling, you're back, and so soon. That's marvelous. I'm talking to those lovely people at Les Classiques.
Yes, right away, my dear. She pulled the phone to her lips.
Thank you so much. You've been very kind.
She hung up. How'd I do? If you ever decide to get out of economics, said Jason, poring through the Paris telephone book, go into sales. I bought every word you said.
Were the descriptions accurate?
To a cadaver and a very limp wrist. Nice touch, the pianist.
It struck me that if she were married, the phone would be in her husband's name.
It isn't, interrupted Bourne. Here it is. D'Albert, Jeanine, Rue Losserand. Jason wrote down the address. Auréal. That's with an O. Like the bird, isn't it? Not A-U.
I think so. Marie lit a cigarette. You're really going to go to their homes?
Bourne nodded. If I pick them up in Saint-Honoré, Carlos will have it watched.
What about the others?
Lavier, Bergeron, whoever he is on the switchboard? Tomorrow. Today's for the groundswell.
The what?
Get them all talking, running around saying things that shouldn't be said. By closing time, word will be spread through the store by D'Albert and Auréal. I'll reach two others tonight. They'll call Lavier and the man at the switchboard. We'll have the first shockwave and then the second. The general's phone will start ringing this afternoon. By morning, the panic should be complete.
Two questions, said Marie, getting up from the edge of the bed and coming toward him. How are you going to get two clerks away from Les Classiques during store hours? And what people will you reach tonight?
Nobody lives in a deep freeze, replied Bourne, looking at his watch. Especially in haute couture. It's 11:15 now. I'll get to D'Albert's apartment by noon and have the superintendent reach her at work. He'll tell her to come home right away. There's an urgent, very personal problem she'd better deal with.
What problem?
I don't know. But who hasn't got one?
You'll do the same with Auréal?
Probably even more effective.
You're outrageous, Jason. I'm deadly serious, said Bourne, his finger once again sliding down a column of names. Here he is. Auréal, Claude Giselle. No comment. Rue Racine. I'll reach him by 3. When I'm finished, he'll head right back to Saint-Honoré and start screaming.
What about the other two? Who are they?
I'll get names from either Auréal or Dolbert or both. They won't know it, but they'll be giving me the second shockwave. Jason stood in the shadows of the recessed doorway in Rue Losserand. He was 15 feet from the entrance to Jeanine Dolbert's small apartment house, where moments before a bewildered and suddenly richer surintendant had obliged a well-spoken stranger by calling Mademoiselle Dolbert at work and telling her that a gentleman in a chauffeured limousine had been around twice asking for her. He was back again. What should the surintendant do? A small black taxi pulled up to the curb, and an agitated, cadaverous Jeanine Dolbert literally jumped out. Jason rushed from the doorway, intercepting her on the pavement, only feet from the entrance. That was quick, he said, touching her elbow. So nice to see you again. You were very helpful the other day. Jeanine Dolbert stared at him, her lips parted in recollection, then astonishment.
You, the American, she said in English. Monsieur Briggs, isn't it? Are you the one who...
I told my chauffeur to take an hour off. I wanted to see you privately.
Me? What could you possibly wish to see me about?
Don't you know? Then why did you race back here? The wide eyes beneath the short bobbed hair were fixed on his, her pale face paler in the sunlight.
You're from the House of Azur, then?
She asked tentatively. I could be. Bourne applied a bit more pressure to her elbow. And?
I've delivered what I promised. There will be nothing more. We agreed to that.
Are you sure?
Don't be an idiot. You don't know Paris couture. Someone will get furious with someone else and make bitchy comments in your own studio. What strange deviations. And when the fall line comes out, with you parading half of Bergeron's designs before he does, how long do you think I can stay at Les Classiques? I'm Lavier's number 2 girl, one of the few who has access to her office. You'd better take care of me as you promised, in one of your Los Angeles shops.
Let's take a walk, said Jason, gently propelling her. You've got the wrong man, Jeanine. I've never heard of the House of Azur, and haven't the slightest interest in stolen designs, except where the knowledge can be useful.
Oh, my God.
Keep walking. Bourne gripped her arm. I said I wanted to talk to you.
About what? What do you want from me? How did you get my name?
The words came rapidly now, the phrases overlapping.
I took an early lunch hour and must return at once. We are very busy today. Please. You're hurting my arm.
Sorry.
What I said. It was foolishness. A lie. On the floor, we've heard rumors. I was testing you. That's what I was doing. I was testing you.
You're very convincing. I'll accept that.
I'm loyal to Les Classiques. I've always been loyal.
It's a fine quality, Jeanine. I admire loyalty. I was saying that the other day to...
What's his name?
That nice fellow on the switchboard.
What is his name? I forget. Philippe, said the sales clerk, frightened, obsequious. Philippe d'Anjou.
That's it. Thank you. They reached a narrow cobblestone alleyway between two buildings. Jason guided her into it. Let's step in here for a moment, just so we're off the street. Don't worry, you won't be late. I'll only take a few minutes of your time. They walked 10 paces into the narrow enclosure. Bourne stopped. Jeanine Dolbert pressed her back against the brick wall. Cigarette? He asked, taking a pack from his pocket.
Thank you, yes.
He lighted it for her, noting that her hand trembled. Relaxed now?
Yes. No, not really. What do you want, Monsieur Briggs? To begin with, the name's not Briggs. But I think you should know that.
I don't. Why should I?
I was sure Lavier's number one girl would have told you.
Monique?
Use last names, please. Accuracy's important.
Creel, then, said Jeanine, frowning curiously. Does she know you?
Why not ask her?
As you wish. What is it, monsieur?
Jason shook his head. You really don't know, do you? Three-quarters of the employees at Les Classiques are working with us, and one of the brightest wasn't even contacted. Of course, it's possible someone thought you were a risk. It happens.
What happens? What risk? Who are you?
There isn't time now. The others can fill you in. I'm here because we've never received a report from you. And yet you speak to prime customers all day long.
You must be clearer, monsieur.
Let's say I'm the spokesman for a group of people. American, French, English, Dutch, closing in on a killer who's murdered political and military leaders in each of our countries.
Murdered? Military? Political?
Jeanine's mouth gaped, the ash of her cigarette breaking off, spilling over her rigid hand.
What is this? What are you talking about? I've heard none of this.
I can only apologize, said Bourne softly, sincerely. You should have been contacted several weeks ago. It was an error on the part of the man before me. I'm sorry. It must be a shock to you.
It is a shock, monsieur,
whispered the sales clerk, her concave body tensed, a bent, lacquered reed against the brick.
You speak of things beyond my understanding.
But now I understand, interrupted Jason. Not a word from you about anyone. Now it's clear.
It's not to me.
We're closing in on Carlos. The assassin known as Carlos.
Carlos?
The cigarette fell from Dolbert's hand, the shock complete. He's one of your most frequent customers. All the evidence points to it. We've narrowed the probabilities down to 8 men. The trap is set for some time in the next several days, and we're taking every precaution.
Precaution?
There's always the danger of hostages, we all know that. We anticipate gunfire, but it will be kept to a minimum. The basic problem will be Carlos himself. He's sworn never to be taken alive. He walks the streets wired up to explosives calculated to be in excess of a 1,000-pound bomb. But we can handle that. Our marksman will be on the scene. One clean shot to the head and it'll be all over.
Un sul bal.
Suddenly Bourne looked at his watch. I've taken up enough of your time. You've got to get back to the shop, and I have to get back to my post. Remember, if you see me outside, you don't know me. If I come into Les Classiques, treat me as you would any rich client. Except if you've spotted a customer you think may be our man. Then don't waste time telling me. Again, I'm sorry about all this. It was a breakdown in communications, that's all. It happens.
Une rupture?
Jason nodded, turned in place, and began walking rapidly out of the alleyway toward the street. He stopped and glanced back at Jeanine Dolbert. She was comatose against the wall. For her, the elegant world of haute couture was spinning wildly out of orbit. Philippe d'Anjou. The name meant nothing to him, but Bourne could not help himself. He kept repeating it silently, trying to raise an image. As the face of the gray-haired switchboard operator gave rise to such violent images of darkness and flashes of light. Philippe d'Anjou. Nothing. Nothing at all. Yet there had been something. Something that caused Jason's stomach to knot, the muscles taut and inflexible, a flat panel of hard flesh constricted by the darkness. He sat by the front window in the door of a coffee shop on the Rue Racine, prepared to get up and leave the moment he saw the figure of Claude Auréal arrive at the doorway of the ancient building across the street.
His room was on the fifth floor, in a flat he shared with two other men, reached only by climbing a worn, angular staircase. When he did arrive, Bourne was sure he would not be walking. For Claude Auréal, who had been so effusive with Jacqueline Lavier on another staircase in Saint-Honoré, had been told by a toothless landlady over the phone to get his sale gueule back to Rue Racine and put a stop to the screaming and smashing of furniture that was taking place in his fifth-floor flat. Either he would stop it or the gendarmes would be called. He had 20 minutes to show up. He did so in 15. His slight frame, encased in a Pierre Cardin suit, rear flap fluttering in the headwind, could be seen racing up the sidewalk from the nearby metro exit. He avoided collisions with the agility of an out-of-shape broken field runner trained by the Ballet Russe. His thin neck was thrust forward several inches in front of his vested chest, his long dark hair a flowing mane parallel to the pavement. He reached the entrance and gripped the railing, leaping up the steps and plunging into the shadows of the foyer. Jason walked rapidly out of the coffee shop and raced across the street. Inside, he ran to the ancient staircase, then started up the cracked steps. From the fourth floor landing, he could hear the pounding on the door above.
Ouvrez! Ouvrez! Vite, nom de Dieu!
Auréal stopped, the silence within perhaps more frightening than anything else. Bourne climbed the remaining steps until he could see Auréal between the bars of the railing and the floor. The clerk's frail body was pressed into the door, his hands on either side, fingers spread, his ear against the wood, his face flushed. Jason shouted in guttural bureaucratic French as he rushed up into view.
Souretez! Stay exactly where you are, young man. Let's not have any unpleasantness. We've been watching you and your friends. We know about the dark room.
No, screamed Auréal. It has nothing to do with me. I swear it. Dark room?
Bourne raised his hand. Be quiet. Don't shout so. He immediately followed his commands by leaning over the railing and looking below.
You can't involve me, continued the sales clerk. I'm not involved. I've told them over and over again to get rid of it all. One day they'll kill themselves. Drugs are for idiots. My God, it's quiet. I think they are dead.
Jason stood up from the railing and approached Auréal, his palms raised.
I told you to shut up, he whispered harshly. Get inside there and be quiet. This was all for the benefit of that old bitch downstairs.
The sales clerk was transfixed, his panic suspended in silent hysteria.
What?
You've got a key, said Bourne. Open up and get inside.
It's bolted, replied Auréal. It's always bolted during these times.
You damn fool, we had to reach you. We had to get you here without anyone knowing why. Open that door. Quickly.
Like the terrified rabbit he was, Claude Auréal fumbled in his pocket and found the key. He unlocked the door and pushed it open as a man might entering a storage vault filled with mutilated corpses. Bourne propelled him through the doorframe, stepped inside, and closed the door. What could be seen of the flat belied the rest of the building. The fair-sized living room was filled with sleek, expensive furniture, dozens of red and yellow velvet pillows scattered about on couches, chairs, and the floor. It was an erotic room. A luxurious sanctuary in the midst of debris.
I've only got a few minutes, said Jason. No time for anything but business.
Business? Asked Auréal, his expression flat out paralyzed. This dark room? What dark room?
Forget it. You had something better going.
What business?
We received word from Zurich and we want you to get it to your friend Lavier.
Madame Jacqueline? My friend?
We can't trust the phones.
What phones? The word? What word?
Carlos is right.
Carlos? Carlos who?
The assassin.
Claude Auréal screamed. He brought his hand up to his mouth, bit the knuckle of his index finger, and screamed.
What are you saying?
Be quiet.
Why are you saying it to me?
You're number 5. We're counting on you.
5 what? For what?
To help Carlos escape the net. They're closing in. Tomorrow, the next day, perhaps the day after that. He's to stay away. He's got to stay away. They'll surround the shop, marksmen every 10 feet. The crossfire will be murderous. If he's in there, it could be a massacre. Every one of you, dead. Boreal screamed again, his knuckle red.
Will you stop this? I don't know what you're talking about. You're a maniac, and I won't hear another word. I haven't heard anything. Carlos, crossfire, massacres. God, I'm suffocating. I need air.
You'll get money. A lot of it, I imagine. Lavier will thank you. Also d'Anjou.
D'Anjou? He loathes me. He calls me a peacock. He insults me every chance he gets.
It's his cover, of course. Actually, he's very fond of you. Perhaps more than you know. He's number 6.
What are these numbers? Stop talking numbers!
How else can we distinguish between you? Allocate assignments. We can't use names.
Who can't?
All of us who work for Carlos. The scream was ear-shattering as the blood trickled from Aurel's finger.
I won't listen. I'm a couturier, an artist.
You're number 5. You'll do exactly as we say, or you'll never see this passion pit of yours again. Stop screaming. We appreciate you. We know you're all under a strain. Incidentally, we don't trust the bookkeeper.
Trignon?
First names only. Obscurity's important.
Pierre, then. He's hateful. He deducts for telephone calls.
We think he's working for Interpol.
Interpol?
If he is, you could all spend 10 years in prison. You'd be eaten alive, Claude. Shut up! Just let Bergeron know what we think. Keep your eyes on Trignon, especially during the next 2 days. If he leaves the store for any reason, watch out. It could mean the trap's closing. Bourne walked to the door, his hand in his pocket. I've got to get back, and so do you. Tell numbers 1 through 6 everything I told you. It's vital the word be spread. Aurel screamed again, hysterically again.
Numbers. Always numbers. What number? I'm an artist, not a number.
You won't have a face unless you get back there as fast as you got here. Reach Lavier, d'Anjou, Bergeron, as quickly as you can. Then the others.
What others?
Ask number 2.
2?
Dolbert. Jeanine Dolbert.
Jeanine? Her 2?
That's right. She's 2. The sales clerk flung his arms wildly above him in helpless protest.
This is madness. Nothing makes sense.
Your life does, Claude, said Jason simply. Value it. I'll be waiting across the street. Leave here in exactly 3 minutes. And don't use the phone. Just leave and get back to Les Classiques. If you're not out of here in 3 minutes, I'll have to return. He took his hand out of his pocket. In it was his gun. Aurel expunged a lungful of air, his face ashen as he stared at the weapon. Bourne let himself out and closed the door. The telephone rang on the bedside table. Marie looked at her watch. It was 8:15, and for a moment she felt a sharp jolt of fear. Jason had said he would call at 9 o'clock. He had left La Terrasse after dark, around 7, to intercept a sales clerk named Monique Briel. The schedule was precise, to be interrupted only in emergency. Had something happened? Is this room 420? Asked the deep male voice on the line. Relief swept over Marie. The man was André Villiers. The general had called late in the afternoon to tell Jason that panic had spread through Les Classiques.
His wife had been summoned to the phone no less than 6 times over the span of an hour and a half. Not once, however, had he been able to listen to anything of substance. Whenever he had picked up the phone, serious conversation had been replaced by innocuous banter.
"Yes," said Marie, "this is 420.
"Forgive me. We did not speak before."
"I know who you are."
"I'm also aware of you. May I take the liberty of saying thank you?"
"I understand. You're welcome."
"To substance. I'm telephoning from my office, and of course, there's no extension for this line. Tell our mutual friend that the crisis has accelerated. My wife has taken to her room, claiming nausea, but apparently she's not too ill to be on the phone. On several occasions, as before, I picked up only to realize that they were alert for any interference. Each time I apologized rather gruffly, saying I expected calls. Frankly, I'm not at all sure my wife was convinced, but of course she's in no position to question me. I'll be blunt, mademoiselle. There is unspoken friction building between us, and beneath the surface it is violent. May God give me strength."
"I can only ask you to remember the objective," broke in Marie. "Remember your son?"
"Yes," said the old man quietly.
"My son.
And the whore who claims to revere his memory. I'm sorry."
"It's all right. I'll convey what you've told me to our friend. He'll be calling within the hour."
"Please," interrupted Villiers, "there's more. It's the reason I had to reach you. Twice while my wife was on the telephone, the voices held meaning for me. The second I recognized, a face came to mind instantly. He's on a switchboard in Saint-Honoré."
"We know his name. What about the first?"
"It was strange. I did not know the voice. There was no face to go with it, but I understood why it was there. It was an odd voice, half whisper, half command, an echo of itself. It was the command that struck me. You see, that voice was not having a conversation with my wife. It had issued an order. It was altered the instant I got on the line, of course. A prearranged signal for a swift goodbye, but the residue remained. That residue, even the tone, is well known to any soldier. It is his means of emphasis. Am I being clear?"
"I think so,"
said Marie gently, aware that if the old man was implying what she thought he was, the strain on him had to be unbearable.
"Be assured of it, mademoiselle," said the general. "It was the killer pig."
Villiers stopped, his breathing audible, the next words drawn out, a strong man close to weeping.
"He was instructing my wife."
The old soldier's voice cracked.
"Forgive me, the unforgivable. I have no right to burden you."
"You have every right," said Marie, suddenly alarmed. "What's happening has to be terribly painful for you, made worse because you have no one to talk to."
"I am talking to you, mademoiselle."
"I shouldn't, but I am."
"I wish we could keep talking. I wish one of us could be with you. But that's not possible. And I know you understand that. Please, try to hold on. It's terribly important that no connection be made between you and our friend. It could cost you your life."
"I think perhaps I have lost it."
"Ça, c'est absurde," said Marie sharply, an intended slap in the old soldier's face. "Vous êtes un soldat. Arrêtez ça immédiatement. C'est l'institutrice qui corrige les mauvais élèves. Vous avez bien raison. On dit que vous êtes un géant. Je le crois."
There was silence on the line. Marie held her breath. When Villiers spoke, she breathed again.
"Our mutual friend is very fortunate. You are a remarkable woman."
"Not at all.
I just want my friend to come back to me. There's nothing remarkable about that.
Perhaps not.
But I should also like to be your friend.
He reminded a very old man of who and what he is.
Or who and what he once was, and must try to be again. I thank you for a second time.
You're welcome, my friend.
Marie hung up, profoundly moved and equally disturbed. She was not convinced Villiers could face the next 24 hours, and if he could not, the assassin would know how deeply his apparatus had been penetrated. He would order every contact at Les Classiques to run from Paris and disappear. Or there would be a bloodbath in Saint-Honoré, achieving the same results. If either happened, there would be no answers, no address in New York, no message deciphered, nor the sender found. The man she loved would be returned to his labyrinth, and he would leave her.
Chapter 28. Bourne saw her at the corner, walking under the spill of the streetlight toward the small hotel that was her home. Monique Brielle, Jacqueline Lavier's number one girl, was a harder, more sinewy version of Jeanine d'Aubert. He remembered seeing her at the shop. There was an assurance about her, her stride, the stride of a confident woman, secure in the knowledge of her expertise. Very unflappable. Jason could understand why she was Lavier's number one. Their confrontation would be brief, the impact of the message startling, the threat inherent. It was time for the start of the second shockwave. He remained motionless and let her pass on the sidewalk, her heels clicking martially on the pavement. The street was not crowded, but neither was it deserted. There were perhaps a half dozen people on the block. It would be necessary to isolate her, then steer her out of earshot of any who might overhear the words, for they were words that no messenger would risk being heard. He caught up with her no more than 30 feet from the entrance to the small hotel. He slowed his pace to hers, staying at her side.
"Get in touch with Lavier right away," he said in French, staring straight ahead.
"Pardon? What did you say?
Who are you, monsieur?
Don't stop. Keep walking. Past the entrance.
You know where I live?
There's very little we don't know.
And if I go straight inside?
There's a doorman.
There's also Lavier," interrupted Bourne. "You'll lose your job and you won't be able to find another in Saint-Honoré. And I'm afraid that will be the least of your problems."
"Who are you?"
"Not your enemy." Jason looked at her. "Don't make me one."
"You. The American. Jeanine. Claude Auréal."
"Carlos," completed Bourne.
"Carlos? What is this madness? All afternoon, nothing but Carlos. And numbers. Everyone has a number no one's heard of. And talk of traps and men with guns. It's crazy."
"It's happening. Keep walking, please, for your own sake." She did. Her stride less sure, her body stiffened, a rigid marionette uncertain of its strings.
"Jacqueline spoke to us," she said, her voice intense. "She told us it was all insane, that it, you, were out to ruin Les Classiques, that one of the other houses must have paid you to ruin us.
What did you expect her to say?"
"You are a hired provocateur. She told us the truth."
"Did she also